all of a sudden,
down version.
You know,
you're the slimmed down version.
And I made myself a
promise. The committee will come to order. First up, we have. Do we have Senate File 516? Is that what you're presenting, Senator Magnus?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. We got a slimmed down version of Senator St. John here presenting the bill today.
It's Senator Magnus.
I can say that. I'm retiring.
Well, certainly it's true, right?
Mr. Chairman and members, Senator Senge is not able to make it, so I said I would be glad to present the bill for him, Senate File 516. I do have one oral amendment I need to make to the bill. It's on line 2.9. Change the effective date from January 1, 2012 to January 1, 2013.
Senator Magnus, we're waiting for one more member to make quorum before we can take official actions on the bill, but we're going to get going here and have you give us your presentation, take some testimony, and when we get another senator in the room, then we can take care of this business. Now, I do understand, Senator Magnus, we heard this bill already, and this amendment really is just to bring it up current to this year is what you're attempting to do.
Right.
Okay.
And Mr. Chairman, the fiscal note, the dates will all change in that too, of course, because that was put together for last year. Well, Mr. Chairman, pretty straightforward bill, but I'll have Mr. Vic Moore explain it.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Hi, Mr. Chairman. It's Vic Moore, and I represent the American Red Cross. And thank you for taking the bill up today. Senator Senge has been the author of this bill for 2 years. This is actually a Rule 47 bill. This committee adopted this bill last year and sent it to the floor, and because we weren't able to take the bill up in the other body, it under Rule 47, it got sent back to the Finance Committee. So it's basically the same bill with the exception of the date change that you saw last year. And just historically, I know he's not here today, but Senator Dick Cohen had carried this bill a few years ago, and the bill has passed the full Senate two or three times. As a former Senate employee, I can refer to the lower body, just never took it up.
Yeah. And Mr. Chairman, we also have, I think, some folks here from Homeland Security and Department of Public Safety, if they want to testify also, too.
Certainly.
Questions of them.
It would be timely, Senator Magnus. We are still waiting for one more member to make quorum, so we certainly have a couple of minutes here.
Well, Pat, Mr. Chairman, it's Pat McCormick with the.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services within the Department of Public Safety. And the Division of Driver and Vehicle Services does not have authority to administer grants. So if this bill would be passed, then the Division of Homeland Security and the director of that division, Chris Eide, is here, and they would be the ones that would administer the grants that would be granted because of the funds that would be collected through Driver and Vehicle Services. And so that's the fiscal cost is associated with their costs in order to administer the grant program.
Thank you very much. For the record, we do have a quorum. Senator Goodwin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Main. I'm not going to pick on you here, but I do want to know, it says pays a fee of $10 for each set of plates. Now, so that actually the plates are cheaper than normal plates? Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin, that is the cost for the plates.
So
just the actual cost of the plates, and then there's the $25 contribution that would be made, and that would be the amount of money that would be used for the Red Cross grants.
Well, Mr. Chair, can I?
Senator Goodwin.
But my question is all they pay for the plates $10? Is that all they pay? So they would pay less for the plates than other people pay for their plates, rather than a special plate fee?
To that point, Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't think it has anything to do with the registration fee that's based on the value of your vehicle. So right. I think that's what she's, Senator Goodwin, yes. is getting at. Maybe you could clarify that, Ms. McCormick.
Certainly. Clarifying that that is above the normal registration fees. Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin, yes, that's just the cost to buy the plates. It doesn't have to do with your registration taxes. That's separate. You need to have plates every 7 years, and so that additional cost would be paid when you buy plates for your vehicle. But your registration taxes, as you know, you pay on an annual basis. When you
Senator Goodwin?
Your tabs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But what is the cost of special plates normally above the registration?
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
No,
okay. Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin, various special plates may have different contribution costs, like the critical habitat has a contribution that goes to the DNR. And so in this particular case, the contribution amount is a minimum of $25. You can provide more money, but that would be the minimum contribution that's part of this bill. And all the plates that have contributions involved, those are the contribution is enumerated in the statute, at least what the minimum has to be. So it can be different depending on the plate and what the contribution is for.
Is that contribution basically on your honor? There's no mechanism to verify or any sort.
No,
the $25.
It's in your bill.
Mr. Chair, you would have to be able to, you'd have to contribute that if you wanted that plate. You'd have to contribute it annually, just like you have to with the critical habitat plate, contribute the minimum amount.
It's on your bill.
Okay, it's paid at the time of
yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
Follow up. I thought specialized plates were normally just when you have a special plate that you want the name on or whatever, were like $50 over a regular registration fee.
Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin, that would be a specialized plate where you determine what your plate has on it. That's one kind of special plate, but as you know, we have 86 different kinds of plates that we administer, and so there's various rules for each plate.
Well, one last comment.
Senator Goodwin.
Mr. Chair. I know why this hasn't gotten through the House in the past, and that's because Representative Bernie Leader did not like the idea of all of these special plates all over the state and thinking that people would just keep coming and coming, and they will. Every group will want their own special plate, and that gets a little confusing for law enforcement and for just kind of having your own slogans and whatever kinds of things. He thought that was kind of was not a good idea, and he had a lot of good reasons for that. So I know why it hasn't gotten through the House before.
Yep.
And I think I agree with him on the number of special plates we could end up having in the state. So I don't know if $10 covers all the cost of making these special plates and of the distribution and so forth, but it seems to me that it would not cover those costs, but maybe you can explain to me how you think it will.
Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin, we now have a digital plate production system, and this does cover the costs that we have. As you know, we have a contract with MinCor, who does the production of the plates. We now call a just-in-time inventory, so that we're not making plates ahead of time because we don't have to. We can just do the graphics, and we have a very streamlined production process. And so, as you know, Driver and Vehicle Services is a fee-based organization, and so. If we believed that the costs were more than that, then we would request authority to be able to increase the costs because we need to pay for the costs in order for us to be able to manage our division and our budget. So time being, this $10 does pay for our costs.
In the past, this was significantly more expensive when we used to stamp the plates. But now it's, I believe all of these are produced in a correctional facility in Rush City, a facility that I represent. So I've taken a look at what they do up there. Senator Ingebrigtsen, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Senator Goodwin's comment, law enforcement in Minnesota is not easily confused. They don't have a problem with this at all.
Well, Mr.
You
Chairman,
speak for all of them, right?
My question.
Senator Magnus.
My question,
oh, Senator
Chair, is the plate design is $1,000 with two designs. Why are there two designs? I guess maybe I've missed that on all the rest of them that have come by. I don't. Is it a contest type thing? Is that what we're talking about?
Mr. Moore? Ms. McCormick? Whoever.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I'm not aware of the reason for the two designs. It may be just to offer more choices to people so that they might. We just administer what TAS is, and this wasn't our initiative. So it would be the American Red Cross that must have made that decision, I think.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Follow-up. I'll have the author get back to me with that. Thank you.
Senator Magnus, do you want to move your bill, or do we have more testimony?
Again, Mr. Chairman, we would make an oral amendment on page 2.9, change the date from 2012 to 2013.
Senator Magnus moves that on law 2.9 we change 2012 to 2013. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, say no.
No.
Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Magnus, do you want to move the bill as amended?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move Senate File 516 as amended to the general orders.
Senator Magnus moves that Senate File 516 as amended be recommended to pass and sent
general
to the floor.
Is there
any discussion?
General Register. I'm sorry. I'm still in the hall. I'm
no,
still
no, Mr. You Chairman, you, right. got, you got it right
I
today.
I got it right this time.
Yes.
I'm going to retire and go back to the house.
Oh,
oh. No, I won't do that. I won't do that.
All those in favor of...
Upper body.
All those in favor of Senator Magnus' motion, please say aye.
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 All those opposed, say no.
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
Bill sent to the floor. Next, I believe we have Senate File 1543, Senator Rosen.
Senator Rosen.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Isn't there a law in the books that if you have a cost savings to finance that you don't have to come in front of your committee?
We like to keep track of those, Senator Rosen, because that means we might be able to spend it somewhere.
That's right. Well, it's not a lot. It is a good thing. Madam Chair, Senate File 1543 is really a great bill, and the main purpose of the bill was passed out last year, and it's in law. And it received strong bipartisan support from in the House and the Senate. And basically it deals with a community paramedic. It puts it in statute, the definition of a community paramedic. And what a community paramedic is, somebody who has a 2-year experience level as a paramedic, and then they must complete a formal training at an accredited college or university, and right now that's MinSCU has that curriculum. And the training must be provided under supervision of an ambulance director, medical director, an advanced practice registered nurse, or a medical professional. So why this is important, this is a great tool for everybody in the state. And what is being addressed at is people in isolated communities. So for Greater Minnesota, it's wonderful. For my little communities of Walters and Ceylons and out there, or those without access to care, or especially for those people who have frequent visits to the emergency room. That's really important. So this is one of the first community paramedics in the nation. It's received glowing reports over the last year, and we were charged with last year also in the statute to determine the specified services and payment rates for these services to be performed by the community paramedics to be covered by medical assistance. So over the interim, Department of Human Services, and I again want to do a shout out to them. They have been just wonderful to work with on this, and of course the boys OJ Doyle and Buck Alpin have been great to work with too, and they came up with some recommendations going forward. And then they again worked, they've had ongoing discussions, and they came up with an amendment that we passed in Health and Human Services 10 days ago or so to determine the optimal language and determining the fiscal note on this. And what we needed to do is to figure out how it was going to affect the MA. So basically, the key provisions of the bill that we passed out of health just a while ago was the community paramedic services will be reimbursed by medical assistance for eligible recipients. An eligible recipient includes an individual who has received hospital emergency delivery, emergency department services 3 or more times in 4 consecutive months in the past 12 months. And an eligible recipient must be identified by their primary health care provider for whom community paramedic services would likely prevent admission to or withhold discharge from a nursing facility or hospital. So there's a real care plan, overall care plan for these individuals, and that's the main thing that we're going after, too. Payment for the community paramedic services must be part of the care plan, as I said, ordered by a primary health care provider in consultation with the ambulance medical director. These services shall also include a health assessment, a chronic disease monitoring, and education, a medication compliance, immunizations, vaccinations, laboratory specimen collection, hospital discharge follow-up care, and minor medical procedures approved by the ambulance medical director. The effective date is July 1st of this year. So as I said, the training curriculum is already in MNSCU, and this new legislation only deals with the specifics of reimbursement under medical assistance with other state programs. So the fiscal note will save $3,000 in FY 2013 all the way up to $8,000 in 2015. And that is basically the program. We are very excited. Like I said, it has received really great welcome, and people are excited about it. You look at the chronic disease out there. You look at 10% of people with diabetes out there. Are people have diabetic issues. 10% of them are receiving proper care. So if we could get them on a care plan to just do some health management for them, we could really lower our cost, our health care cost. And this is one way of doing it. So I think it's been laid out very well. And with that, I have Buck Alpin. Talk about it.
Madam Chair and members, Buck McAlpin. I do government affairs for North Memorial, and I'm the legislative chair of our State Ambulance Association. Senator Rosen covered the bill very well, but we've started to implement community paramedics since last year. The payment piece was the big piece that we wanted to do. As the senator said, we're the first in the country to put this into law. Everybody else has tried to do it off grants, and their programs have failed. We originally thought this was a really good project for rural Minnesota. It's still a big part of it. We're doing some pilot projects out there now to help with some rural staffing issues and put advanced care practitioners in small communities. But as we looked at a system the size of North Memorial or Alliana or Health East or Mayo and Gold Cross Ambulance, lots of our payment methodologies, partnering with our health plans, are based off total cost of care, shared savings, and decreasing the spend that you realize in some of the state budget this year. The third class, the community paramedics, is going right now. We have 10 of our medics from North in the program, and we're going to aggressively implement them in the metro area. And we have thousands of people that we have to care coordinate. Over 50% of our ER discharges that come back within 30 days are mental health and chemical dependency based. We know that's quite a spend for the state, and we're designing some very aggressive models about how we put that together. So we sure appreciate your support moving it forward. We were just awarded 2 weeks ago $250,000 to MNSCU from the Department of Economic Development and Labor to train 100 community medics over the next 3 years. So we see the program moving forward pretty aggressively in the next 36 months to put folks out there.
Senator Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And whichever of you want to address it, I'm still, you've explained it, but I still do not, when I think of a paramedic, it's the person who is in the ambulance riding with you on the way to the hospital. This appears to be something other than that. So tell me, where do they work? I mean, it's paramedics working in a different environment. Could you describe that a little bit more in terms of how sure. that's accessed and what they do?
Mr. Yeah. McAlpin.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, originally when we started this last year, the nurses came to us and had some concerns about that, thinking that the paramedic would be in someone's home providing primary care services, and a 911 call came in. Actually, the way the system's being set up is these folks in rural Minnesota, where you do 100 runs a year, you could probably have that ambulance stop by and do some of that. In the metro, in Hennepin County, there's 105,000 ambulance calls a year. Those folks are too busy to do primary care. We're setting our model up where these folks are separate practitioners, where they'll be in a vehicle and not in a 911 ambulance because they're just too busy to do that. So the ordinary 911 paramedic will still be there. But what we found is the paramedic career is only in the 70s, and all of a sudden a group of us, have hit 60, and we've got a glutton of older, very experienced paramedics that we need to get off the ambulance and have them do different care. So we also see this as a model to help keep folks between 60, 65, and 70 that can't work on the ambulance. And probably after about 55, they're pretty beat up healthcare-wise, lifting stretchers and stuff, that we want to move them into this program. So they'll be separate from what we do with 911 work. Across the country, there's been some misinformation about how they do that, but we think here we've kind of honed in on that, of how we should set up these practitioners.
So, Madam Chair, Senator Olson. So they are sent in response to an emergency-type call, but it may not involve the patient leaving the home. They can address it at home, but that's where I suppose the nurses might be on a different kind of schedule. But is this more in a response to an emergency, or I'm still trying to understand just how that functions?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson. Our national data will show us that we can care plan about 2% of the ambulance volume away. So in a large EMS system, when a 911 ambulance responds for an acute medical condition, those folks will be treated the same way they are today. We didn't want to jeopardize the ambulance response system. We know by doing good follow-up and putting someone in a care plan and care coordination, we'll decrease some of that. But these folks will be used separately where when they're in the care plan, after they come through our ER and evaluated, that's where the community paramedic will come in the backside and take care of them.
So, Madam Chair, then
Senator Olson,
then that seems consistent with the nurses' concerns. Why would they not? The nurse practitioners that would be visiting nurses, and so on. How is that different from that?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, what we've worked with the nurses, we met with them a couple of Fridays ago, is we wanted to be sure we didn't duplicate services. That's an important part of this.
So distinguish between them, please.
Yep. There's things called in-home and homebound, things that I've learned more about home health the last year than I think OJ and I thought would happen. But some folks qualify for certain services that they're reimbursed for. Some qualify for services that we're not reimbursed for. One thing we'll use the community paramedic for, we've just identified 200 patients at North that have no insurance coverage. It's easier for us to use our community paramedics for some of those folks because they're not being care planned for now. So we're looking at people that may require one visit a week where our home health and what we do with our nurse practitioners and nurses can be 5 days a week of home health care. That's not what we're looking for with community paramedics. It's somebody that came in the first time, needs someone to stop by for an hour and make sure that their medications are reconciled, that their blood pressure is okay, so that they don't come back to the hospital within 30 days because it may be a single person at home that's 75 years old that wasn't followed up on, that didn't qualify for home health but did qualify for a single visit.
Senator Olson.
So, Madam Chair, is this then aim particularly at those, when you say the uninsured, it helps a hospital reduce the charity care costs by being able to deliver those services in a less expensive manner?
Madam Chair, Senator, absolutely.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And these are very good questions, Senator Olson, and appreciate that. It was basically last year targeted towards the frequent flyers. That's what they call them, the ones that go to the hospitals over and over again for their primary care, for that uncompensated care that's costing the hospitals a fortune. So you're exactly right. This was how we geared to it. But after further looking at it and talking to all the interest groups, we realized that this is in concert with a care plan. You can be directed and go to these people that need, you know, a consistent watching but still run unison with the nursing, the in-home and the homebound also. So it was really well received from Greater Minnesota because we have obviously a deficit of this in-home care out there. But we have the frequent flyers. We have people that don't have the access to care out there. But also we're seeing in the fiscal note, too, at Hennepin County, the high emergency room utilizers are – there is about, let's see, high utilizers of emergency rooms number about 4,000 individuals annually with an average of 2,000 annually in ER services. So you take even 20% of those at Hennepin County, that's 800. It goes on. It's in the fiscal note here. I mean, these are – I think these are actually conservative numbers, too. And when you get these frequent flyers on a – on just – you know, give them some attention and give them on a consistent plan. And whether it's every week or every 2 weeks or 10 days and 2 weeks the next time, whatever, but they just need to stay away from the emergency room and start getting some consistent care. So it's in cooperation and coordination with the home health care.
You know, Senator Rosen, I think this is a great idea. Just from my own family's experiences, I had a grandma who had congestive heart failure. And every now and then she'd get really faint and sometimes would collapse or you know start vomiting and get real weak and she lived alone, and if she called someone quick, they'd come over and say, "We're going to call the ambulance." And so she got multiple rides in the ambulance. And then what we never realized, as soon as she got in the ambulance and they gave her a little oxygen, she was fine. And now my dad has the same thing. And we had a few trips to the hospital in an ambulance with him. And my mother, who's a great caregiver, and, you know, he doesn't live alone, she decided she's going to get a tank of oxygen at home. So now when that starts to happen, my mom puts the oxygen on. And in a matter of minutes, he's just fine. But in the days past, the ambulance would have come. And even though they would have given him oxygen, they always said, well, you're better now, but we better take you in just to check you out. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it resulted in an overnight stay in the hospital as they ran multiple tests again and then found out that there was nothing new wrong, but they had checked them out. And so I think if somebody has a caregiver who can come in and just kind of monitor everything, and now with my dad's congestive heart failure, it's a retention of fluid. So if you get him on the scale on a regular basis to see if he's retaining fluid, and then they can do things about that, watching the salt intake and the fluid intake, it will matter, mm-hmm. because otherwise you have all these trips going. Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You're so right. That's a great example. And like I said, when these guys first started and brought it to me, I thought so too, because, it's in coordination with an ambulance medical director, an advanced practice registered nurse, or other medical professionals. So that care plan has to be in place. These hospitals and doctors know who the frequent flyers are. They do. It's a repeat. They know who's coming in, and so they can build a plan. And especially out in Greater Minnesota, where our home health care is being cut, yeah. We have very, very. It's getting very limited, and the Mayo just cut ours out of our little community. We have seniors that are in nursing homes for diabetic care. Now that's ridiculous, and they could get their care at home in a coordinated care plan, and save a lot of money for the state going forward.
Senator Bonner.
Madam Chair, just a question for I'm not sure who, but could you explain the distinction in education between a nurse and a paramedic? What is the cost to educate a paramedic versus a nurse, and how long is the training for both, and how does that differ, and what do you see as the difference between those two?
Mr. McAlpin.
Sure, Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff. There's a two-year nursing program. The paramedic program is now being taught. When OJ and I went, it was about a year program, a certificate program. Minnesota is still a certification state for medics, which is nice because it allows us to do things like this under the scope of our medical director. It also allows very advanced care to be done pre-hospitally in our helicopters and ambulances because our medical directors take quite the risk. But most of the programs now are two-year associate degree programs for paramedics. The community paramedic piece is an additional 200 hours, about 96 hours of classroom, and the rest is putting them out in primary care clinics, working with home health, emergency rooms, and some of our community health clinics in North Minneapolis to change their mindset from emergency care to coordinated primary well care. And that's about where it stops, and the nursing program is about 2 years. The cost from, I'm not sure what a nursing program costs, but a paramedic program for about 2 years is about $10,000.
Are there any other questions? Anyone else in the audience who wants to testify for or against the bill? If not, Senator Olson.
Be happy to move the bill.
Moves that Senate File 1543 be recommended to pass. There's no other discussion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The bill will be placed on general orders.
Thank you, Madam
Thank you,
Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Senator Olson, committee members. Appreciate it.
Next up on our agenda is Senate File 1975. It's Senator DeCry's bill. Good morning, Senator DeCry.
Good morning, Madam Chair, and good morning, committee.
Do you want to start by explaining your bill, please, Senator DeCry?
Yes. Madam Chair, essentially, Senate File 1975 is a bill to allow operations to continue on for the Racing Commission and the state lottery in event of another state shutdown. The state shutdown in the summer of 2011 was devastating to the racing industry in Minnesota. The industry pays 100% of the regulatory costs to the Minnesota Racing Commission and generates revenue to the state when they are operating. So shutting the racing industry down during a state shutdown is unnecessary. The money to regulate horse racing was in the bank during the shutdown and made no sense that the Minnesota Racing Commission was unable to access these funds. Canterbury Park and Running Aces are private businesses that suffer significant financial harm, some of which are unique to their industry when their industry is caused to shut down. For them to conduct a race meet, they need to be able to recruit horsemen from around the country to ship their horses to Minnesota for the summer. These recruited horsemen incur significant expenses in moving and need to be certain that they have the opportunity to race. Winning prize purse money is the only way they derive income. This group travels to Minnesota and have many other options of places to race during the summer and won't come here if there's uncertainty. I am aware of only one other time in the 150-year history of racing that racing was shut down due to a government shutdown of regulators, and that was in New Jersey in 2005. If another shutdown were to be experienced like the one in 2011, it could cause irreparable harm to the racing industry, which also includes many other small businesses that support it. This includes the thoroughbred industry, the quarter horse, standardbred horsemen, owners, trainers, jockeys, drivers, grooms, and hot walkers, veterinarians, farriers, and others. The state government shutdown executive summary created by the Minnesota Management and Budget lists the lottery revenue loss of $9.98 million. In 2011, and Madam Chair, quite frankly, when we're arguing about money, I just don't think it makes from a businessman's perspective. When you are arguing about money, shutting the money source off just doesn't make any sense to me at all.
Thank you, Senator DeCry. Are there any questions about the bill? We've seen a number of these.
Madam Chair,
Senator Langston,
I would say shutdowns don't make any sense at all. If we do our job in a democratic process, there shouldn't be shutdowns. That's what doesn't make any sense. And what we're setting up here is just an ability to just go on and on and on.
Senator Langseth, I would argue that this probably should have been handled a long time ago because the money is put into an account from the licensing, and it is exclusively for that use, and it's what keeps the Racing Commission running. And I guess this is one thing that could be on autopilot because there's no other use for that money. And so I think that whether we ever have a shutdown again or not, it is something that unless we quit licensing them and quit taking their money, it should always be appropriated for that use. And I think it's very appropriate that we look at it. And you're right. We don't want another shutdown. But I know the damage that this caused, and we had people laid off for 3 weeks, a lot of them seasonal workers, college students who get a lot of their revenue during the summer from working at the racetracks, and that was gone. And a private business so seriously impacted by this. I mean, you understand if it's something that the state actually is providing, but the state is just overseeing the operation through the Racing Commission, and shutting down that little office of a handful of people shut down a business in Shakopee with 1,100 employees. And so it was just a travesty, and they're private businesses, the racetracks are. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In addition to this being a private business in terms of the racetracks, the equine industry in the state of Minnesota is enormous. It's a billion-dollar-a-year industry, and it isn't just the folks that are directly involved in the racing. It's the veterinarians and the farriers. It's the farmers out in my district who raise the hay and raise the feed for these animals. So it stretches in a much wider sphere than just running Aces or Canterbury. And so either to Senator Rosen, Roebling, you probably know this answer, or possibly to Crive. Can we put on the record specifically, this is an industry that has the money to keep running. And but as a result of the shutdown, these private businesses stopped. I'd like to know specifically on the record, what was it about the shutdown that caused these businesses to have to stop their operations when they had the money to continue?
We have Mr. Kruger in the audience, who is the head of the Racing Commission, and he could probably explain that best. Welcome, Mr. Kruger.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dick Kruger, the executive director of the Racing Commission. To respond to your question, Senator, I've always categorized it that you can't play a football game without referees or a baseball game without umpires. Mm-hmm. We hire the stewards that are up in the steward stand that oversee all of the racing that goes on. They have their morning duties in the morning where they're dealing with our investigators, and you just can't conduct parimutuel wagering without those officials up in the stand. And that's what caused the racetracks to have to shut down.
You know, they have people who make sure that the horses aren't being given illegal drugs. They even have people who weigh the jockeys. Isn't that part of it?
That's
they have
correct.
Them jump on the scale. And there's a multitude of little oversights that they provide that they felt, we couldn't continue the operation without that oversight. So that's why it shut down. And it didn't stop the other expenses from occurring. The animals still all had to be cared for. The stables were all operational and busy during that time, but nobody could earn any money because they only get that money from purse money. Any other questions, Senator Stumpf?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. We've seen a number of these bills come through, and there's probably dozens and dozens of other areas that could be addressed. Wouldn't it make more sense to try to figure out a plan so that any future shutdown would be diverted, or not necessarily diverted, but the process would work in a more mutual way? I mean, when you think about, I went back after some of the bills hit the floor relating to this, and I read all of the articles that I could find anyway, as to who was to blame, and the papers, for the most part, were equally distributing the blame between the executive branch and the legislative branch. And it seemed like the way to tackle this whole issue isn't so much by individual bill after individual bill, because obviously if any one of these would be signed into law, it would create a precedent for, you know, umpteen others that we can't even imagine right now. I wonder if there wouldn't be a way that we could sit down with the executive branch, and I know we have processes in the legislature through deadlines and so on, but if we couldn't put some additional processes in place that would assure an agreeable outcome before something like this could occur. It just seems like that would be a much more rational approach than each individual area that we've seen come before this committee. It might be something that we could look at over the summer or interim or something, or maybe have even staff from both the executive branch and the legislative branch figure out what components they could put together that might assist that.
And Senator Stump, there are ideas being formulated on that very issue, and I think we're going to have a broader discussion on that, because there could be another process developed on how it would be handled before we'd ever end up in a situation like we did last year. And it was hard on everyone. I know how stressed out Governor Dayton was. I know how stressed out I was and all of us and all of our leaders. And I think none of us want that to happen again. And so we're continuing to work on something that we hope to bring to this committee this year yet. Senator Olson?
Well, I think the sure thing for not having it happen again is that if the government shut down, there would be an automatic recall elections called for the entire legislature and the governor. I think that would probably speed things up.
Some people say that all of our pay and the governor's, all that would all be cut off too. I mean, there's a variety of ideas that would maybe spur us on. And in this case, there was definitely incentive to continue operation and not to have a shutdown. I mean, I think that efforts were made in that direction, and they just were not successful, but we have to figure out how else we can do that. So, anyway, I know we've had this discussion several times in this committee, and we will be looking at some other proposals, but for now, we've got Senator DeKreif's bill in front of us, and if we don't get a global agreement on this, maybe we could pass this one out. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
With that, Senator, I would move Senate File 1975 to pass.
On that motion, all in favor of Senator Ingebrigtsen's motion that 1975 be recommended to pass and be placed on general order, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay.
No.
The motion does prevail. The bill will be placed on general orders. Thank you, Senator DeKreif.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Our final bill for today is Senate File 1911. Senator Gazelka is here to present that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Election would be a bit of a spur.
Senator Gazelka, if you'd like to start by explaining the bill to us, please.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senate File 1911 has a similar vein to the last bill that you heard relating to allowing hunting and fishing licenses to continue to be purchased even if there was a shutdown. Article 13 of the Constitution, miscellaneous subjects, Section 12, hunting and fishing and the taking of game and fish are a valued part of our heritage that shall be forever preserved for the people and shall be managed by law and regulated for the public good. I just wanted to mention that in our Constitution, members, that this is something that we should not prohibit the citizens of Minnesota from doing. And the reason why I'm bringing this forth, members, Madam Chair and members, it really hit my area, the Brainerd Lakes area, very, very hard. Many of you have been to the resorts that we have up there. And to suddenly not be able to offer fishing licenses for the resorts and the tourism industry up there was catastrophic. There was an estimated 20,000 less non-residential fishing license purchased because of this. And many of those people, frankly, are coming up to the resorts in my area. So it was a very, very big deal. For the DNR, they estimate, and the fiscal note estimates, approximately $2.2 million of lost revenue there. But, you know, that's just a small portion of this. And this would allow people to continue to buy their fishing or hunting licenses electronically. You know, if you go to Gander Mountain or Cabela's or Mills Fleet Farm or wherever you go to buy your license, you do it electronically. You go there, you purchase it, and you go and fish. Crow Wing County took some action on their own. They passed some resolutions to say we want to encourage the DNR to let people fish, and we'll deal with it after. Even our local DNR folks thought that that was appropriate, and they started to move that forward, but then the state DNR said we can't do that. And so that's what this bill is about. It's very simple. The fiscal note is zero, but you can see farther into that that it shows, you know, that what the costs were to the DNR by not allowing those fishing licenses to be purchased.
Thank you, Ms. Senator Gazelka. I see you have a testifier. Mr. Leaf, did you want to say something?
Yes, my name is, Madam Chair, my name is Gary Leaf. I'm Executive Director of Sportsmen for Change, and we do hunting and fishing grassroots advocacy. And just wanted to talk a little bit about what Senator Gazelka's bill was talking about. Mainly when that occurred, there was a lot of input by sportsmen all around the state finding out, well, wait a minute, didn't we in 1998, after 4 years of effort, pass the constitutional right to hunt and fish? These particular constitutional amendments go back to the founding of the country. Vermont passed the first one in 1777, so they're very early in our tradition, and a lot of people have felt that unlike maybe some other areas that occur or whatever, that we actually had constitutional standing but didn't pursue it. But the Constitution states that hunting and fishing should be, in essence, preserved for the public, for the people in Minnesota, and so on. The constitutional right to hunt and fish took about 4 years ultimately get on the ballot. It was ratified by 76-77% of the vote, possibly the highest of any constitutional amendment in the state of Minnesota. Senator Lessard carried that bill. Most of the newspapers editorialized against it. That seemed to help it. The more that the Star and Tribune and Pioneer Press had cartoons about the lack of need for it, the more it seemed to increase in support for it. So we think this assists in the intent with what the voters approved, beyond what the executive branch or the legislature wanted or views or whatever, and it passed at the ballot. So we think that this is a good bill that should it, this event occur again, would maintain hunting and fishing.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Gazelka. I'm not sure if I'm thinking of the right bill, but in terms of the issuance of hunting and fishing licenses electronically, the means to do this is available even though the government went into shutdown. And I'm thinking that they were issued by some company out of Tennessee or something. But I guess what's most important is that the issuance of the licenses electronically are available in the event of a government shutdown. Am I correct on that?
Senator Gazelka?
Madam Chair, Senator Newman, that is correct because they're purchased through private companies. They, in the fiscal note, there was some assumptions that there were three employees necessary to keep electronic licensing system operational. Yeah. But frankly, you're buying them over the counter and, should be able to move forward on that. But that's in the fiscal note.
Thank you.
So we have a contract with a private vendor who supplies the electronic means to get the licenses then.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This came before my committee, I believe, and there was testimony there about the three employees, and what the three employees kept on to do or would be kept on to do should there be a shutdown are, I think, fairly well described in the fiscal note here. However, even though we do have an out-of-state vendor, we have what's called, I think they call them even in here, sweepers. We have to have somebody that sweeps those accounts every so often. In other words, bring the money back into the state treasury. So that made it a little more clear as to why or what type of employees we were talking about that would have to stay on board. I really have to agree with this bill due to the fact that this is a constitutional amendment to be able to hunt and fish in Minnesota, and I wasn't around in 1998. I can't imagine anybody taking a stand against which has been all of our parents and grandparents' heritage for many, many years in the state of Minnesota, to control and manage both wildlife and fish. But nevertheless, it did happen, and as Mr. Leaf explained, it was overwhelming. That sends a real strong message, I think, that people in Minnesota, what people in Minnesota feel about this. And to shut this down, I mean, you're looking at figures of losing out on millions of dollars worth of revenue, just as absolutely irresponsible. And in my area, as well as Senator Gazelka's area, we have a lot of people that were scheduled to come months ahead of time to our state and enjoy our resources, and when they get here, they can't fish. It was just beyond even an average person's thought process that they wouldn't be able to get a license, and it was a real confusing thing for the DNR as well. So I absolutely support this bill. I think it's a good bill.
You know, it's too bad that someone wasn't thinking about the constitutional right and take it before the special master. It probably would have had a good chance of getting continued with that argument, but it wasn't tried. And if it had gone on any longer, I'm sure it would have. But it would have been a very convincing argument, I think. Senator Gazelka.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And you know, we're looking at the impact to the state, you know, and which is our role, but having been in the area that really had the impact to tourism, you know, the impact to the communities and to the businesses and to all the people that enjoy it was far greater than the little impact it had to us at the state.
Thank you. Is there a motion? Senator Newman moves that Senate File 1911 be recommended to pass. Is there anyone in the audience who want to testify for or against? Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could Senate Counsel just refresh my memory as to how the process of binding future legislatures on two things that I'm just thinking of? One is how we can appropriate money without actually the legislature doing it, such as this open and standing appropriations. And then the other one is how do we bind future legislatures by this approach?
Madam Chair and Senator Stumpf, what you see on page 2 of the bill in paragraph D is in effect a statutory appropriation, and there's an open amount from the general fund for the amounts necessary for some of the support functions. That is similar to a whole variety of other statutory appropriations that are already enacted. You asked how that binds future legislatures. They are not prohibited from passing a law that would either not withstand this, repeal it, adjust it in some manner. That, of course, would require the enactment of the law and presumably the cooperation of the governor in doing that. So this is binding, but in the sense that it takes another law to change it, but it doesn't become, it is not, it's subject to change.
Madam Chair, and is it possible to get a you know, a fiscal note on when we add up all of these bills that we have projecting to spend for the tails on all these bills that we are looking at and have passed?
Senator Stumpf, in most cases such as this, there's actually revenue coming in by guaranteed to keep coming in. If we do it, we're guaranteed to lose money if we don't, and there would be another shutdown. I suppose we could add them up or some sort of projections on them. But I think in almost every case, except Senator Kreis in the last case, the money was already there. Maybe we should reimburse them for a percent of their license that they didn't benefit from because the money had already been paid in. And so, there's usually, I'm sure the savings or the additional revenue coming in would surpass the amount. It just is a question of, are we willing to give statutory appropriations to some of these areas? And the ones that are bringing in revenue in particular, I think, are not unusual that we might do that. Okay. There's no other questions. Senator Newman renews his motion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Nay.
No.
The motion does prevail. Senate file 1911 will be placed on general orders. Thank you, Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
And members, that's it for our agenda today, and we will plan to meet again on Tuesday. So have a good weekend.
Madam Chair, are we going to be doing some Fridays